Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Todd Schwanke. I'm the moderator for the computer application session today. If you're looking for the, I think it's either the RERC or the student competition, that is Switch Next Door. We have five presenters today. We have about 15 minutes each. We want to keep moving along. Each presenter will have a chance for like 2 to 5 minute question and answer at the end. And if it gets to be beyond that, we'll ask that we stop and save any additional questions till the end, so if you tend to forget, just write them down quick. I'm sure presenters, depending on what they have going on afterwards, would be willing to stay around and chat with you individually. So. All right. So, make sure you get your CEU paperwork in and stick around for the number at the end. We'll also try to finish up here before everybody turns into popsicles because it is mighty cold in here. Let's see. Starting out, we have Kim Adams from the University of Alberta. She's going to be speaking on the development of an interface for integration of communication and play. And the next presenter, if we get to 15 minutes, the next presenter can feel free to come on up here and give a really big hint that time is up. So.
Hello, my name is Kim Adams, and my co-authors are Mark Corrigan and Al Cook, and we're all in Edmonton, Alberta. Now, the overarching theory that we're operating under is that children learn cognitive, social, motor, and linguistic skills through play. However, the problem is that the quality of play may be compromised for children that have disabilities. And so our research program is around facilitating access to spontaneous play for children with disabilities. Now, Al Cook has been doing this for a while, and he started with industrial robots, which can be rather large and expensive. And so thanks to an idea from Rich Simpson, we've been using Lego Mindstorms programmable robots. And through these, children have had access to a variety and a challenge in play activities, and they've had an opportunity to demonstrate skills in the cognitive, motor, and social areas. But there were limitations in those studies, and one of them is that they used this adapted controller to control the robots using 1 to 4 single switches. However, to have full access to a robot arm, you need 6 degrees of freedom for the gripper, the up and down, and the left and right. And so what we need is alternative access methods to control the robots. And also children haven't had an opportunity to communicate while they're controlling the robots. And there's an example of this is when a child, we thought she was going completely off task, but her mother was there to help interpret for us, luckily. And although this girl was running over top of the forest, which we had as props, what she really wanted to do was pick up a tree and decorate it because it was close to Christmas. So she was being innovative, but if we didn't have her mom there to translate for us, we would never have known that. And this is a problem that Janice Light and Catherine Dreger have highlighted as well, that you have access to either communication, the device in front of you, or the play toys. And so they challenged people to integrate those items, the communication and play. And so with us, we can capitalize on that rich play environment with the robots and the rich communication environment. Now that communication devices have infrared control, they can control our infrared robots. And we have access to alternative access methods. Some people have already started looking into this in Minnesota and Australia. And I've been doing a pilot project with a girl using a Vantage who's doing two-step scanning. And she's doing some things to integrate into her curriculum, and she's actually programming the Lego Mindstorm software too, using it. But we're looking at perhaps there's an advantage to having a system that we have more control over. And in one of those areas, how do we display vocabulary and robotic movement together? Now, there's another study that Light and Drager did where they compared interface techniques with a visual scene display, a grid array, encoding. But it was a little bit like comparing apples and oranges. And if we have a platform that we can present several techniques in one platform with one symbol set, then it might be a little bit more like apples and apples. The next thing is allocation of function to the robot. Now, the robot can take control of a lot of the play activity if the child is not capable of doing that. And we can use things like scripting, programming to do that. So, for example, if the sheep toy has already been moved, then take that away as one of the options. And then we have this complex environment with many interacting factors. And we need to keep track of the human gestures, the robot movements, as well as the typical data logging things that AAC devices can do. Now, we have to be careful, and although there's been a shift away from AT for people with disabilities being designed by people without disabilities, there is still an issue where AT for children with disabilities is typically designed by adults without disabilities. And so we want to take a principled approach to the design and the usability testing of those products. So we're starting with a test platform. And these are the characteristics which address those robotic play issues. And then we performed usability evaluations on it. So the hardware that we used was a tablet computer that had a resistive touch screen so people could use their fingers. And the software we used was AT Creator, which is by Medentech, which provided that functionality that we needed. Red Rat infrared output, and we had our two robots, our arm and our roverbot. And the people who trialed it for us first were experts in a variety of fields. So we had a speech-language pathologist, a rehabilitation engineer, two psychologists, one who specializes in human factors and the other in pediatrics. And then we had an adult who uses an augmentative communication device, and she is a direct access user. Now, these experts did usability prototype analysis, which is essentially thinking aloud while you're using the interface. And we did a slight variation on that called user dialogue, where it's not an impartial observer who's with the expert, but the actual designers, so that there could be a dialogue between the user and the designers. And then after each expert had used the interface and made their comments, modifications were made, and then it was presented to the next user. We also used this heuristic evaluation tool by Xerox. It's a pretty extensive checklist. There are 200 and some odd items on it. Some we had to tailor for our purposes. So as far as data collection went, we used this picture-in-picture video. It was necessary, when you're working with children, we want to be able to see both the face and the play environment for things like if the child moves to hit the switch first and then their eyes go to the robot, then we can assume that they have cause and effect and those sorts of cognitive skills. Another thing that we used was Moray usability software. And here, the interactions on the computer screen can be captured at the same time as the video, and it automatically detects when mouse clicks occur. And there's a software development kit that we can import the AT Creator log file data into here. So it's all in one file. So here are a few sample interfaces. If someone's at a low cognitive skill and low physical skill level, we could have one button. And if you press on there, then the robot can perform an entire play task, an entire sequence. And then you can start reducing the target size. If you press on the sheep, the robot can go and get the sheep and put it somewhere. We can look at visual scene displays where these hot spots target functions. So if you press on the face, then it goes forward. So this is where the child starts to be allocated more function. We want to make these hot spots of unusual shapes so that they're not just square. And we actually used this way and that way instead of left and right, because as soon as the car turns around, left and right become different things. And then finally, a visual scene display does become quite limited in the language that it can portray, and so children will progress to a grid array, and then you can integrate the communication symbols along with the moving symbols. And so we found that this protocol was quite useful for us in our development of those interfaces. As far as usability goes, the efficacy, it can support a range of physical, cognitive and linguistic skills. Physical was what was tested here was a touch array, but we do want to, it has the potential to support others. Efficiency, we need to look at time and physical effort, and we'll do that with actual children, I should say. And the satisfaction of the AAC user who grew up as a child with communication limitations, she said, "This is my first time actually playing with stuff. Before I just watched my sister play with her toys." So she was quite satisfied with it. So in the future, we want to, as I said, test the usability testing with children without and with disabilities. We have technical challenges to address because LEGO now is Bluetooth controlled rather than infrared control. Scanning is going to be a good challenge when you have the moving highlight at the same time as a moving robot. And we may utilize this interface in single participant studies and produce resources for parents and teachers to use these robots in the school or in the home environments. And since they're so affordable, we think that will be possible. The end. Thank you. Time for questions? Todd, is there time for questions? Kevin.
How are we using
Moray? You saw the screen where it can capture what's happening on the computer screen at the same time as what we're looking at. And also automatically records when the mouse clicks occur. So previously, we've been trying to do this manually by having two separate cameras and watching and stopping and writing down the times. And so this way, it helps to speed up that manual process. There are other usability software packages out there that are quite expensive. We can get up to $10,000 for them. This one's a lot cheaper. Data with the mouse clicks, that can be dumped into a spreadsheet, and then you can tabulate how many there were and which types they were. You can also, as you're watching the video, you can flag when the child laughed, for instance, and when they vocalized, and then you can tabulate those as well.
Thank you.
Thanks, Kim. Next, we have Kevin Caves from Duke University. He's going to be speaking on the development of an automatic recognizer for dysarthric speech. And just a general request to the speakers, when people ask questions in the audience, if you could repeat those questions or paraphrase those questions so that it goes onto the recording and that everybody in the room can clearly hear it.
Yeah, you gonna give me little time things? Hi, my name is Kevin Caves. I'm at Duke University. I work with the Rehabilitation Engineering Research Center on Communication Enhancement. I'm here representing my collaborators, Brad Cope, Steve Boehmler, at the NAVAIR Training Systems Division in Orlando, Florida. They're a Department of Navy research group. I'll tell you a little bit more about that in a bit. So automatic speech recognition systems have been around for a number of years. The ASR systems allow individuals to do typing without the use of their hands, to input text and control a computer. And lots of studies have done. Heidi did a really nice summary article a couple of years ago about some of the challenges that people have in using it, and has done a lot of work looking at the people with disabilities using ASR systems. So it's a notable challenge for folks that have speech impairment, though, to use automatic speech recognition systems. And, you know, depending on where you pull your stats from, there are between 1 and 14 million people in the U.S. that have speech disorder that affects the way they talk. Dysarthria, which is the condition I was interested in, is a speech disability that results in slurred speech. It's often caused by impairment of the oral motor muscles used to form the speech, and it's common in stroke and TBI as well as neurological disorders, such as cerebral palsy, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, multiple sclerosis, and Parkinson's disease. As part of the RARC, we set out it's really a feasibility study, to look at if we could build a speaker-independent voice recognition system that will recognize dysarthric speech. There's been a fair amount of work looking at the recognition of dysarthric speech in the literature, but it's always been based from using speech recognition models that are based on typical speakers. So in a visit with a federal lab consortium, yeah, that sounds pretty interesting, doesn't it? It sounds like the walls are falling down behind us. In a visit with the Federal Lab Consortium, we met this group in Orlando, and they developed training simulations for Navy things. So it was a fun trip for me because I got to go down, and that's a high-tech term. I got to go down to Orlando and park a sub, and I got to fly a fighter plane, and I got to land planes on the deck of an aircraft carrier. So it was quite cool. But as part of what they do in their training simulations, they're really good at building speech recognition models. So when I was controlling the sub, I had a little microphone, and I would say, 3 degrees to port ahead. Yeah, warp factor 6, whatever it was. and then the system would respond in real time to my command. One of the ones we were most impressed with is they have this simulation of an aircraft landing deck. So you're landing on the carrier, on the deck of an aircraft carrier, and there's a guy who, and he's an officer, because you would think that officers would be able to get out of this job, but he stands at the edge of the deck of the carrier with jets landing over his head and the ship going up and down, and he talks the planes in. And it's a really high noise environment, like 120 decibels on the deck of the carrier. And they've developed a speech recognition system for these guys that in their training can be used. So they'll say you're a little bit high and you're looking off at a simulation of the deck of the carrier and the plane coming in, and the plane will actually move down in response to that. The other thing about it is that they don't say you're a little high. They say you're a little high, because they use those changes in pitch to compensate for, you know, the decreased fidelity. So these guys are used to building, but all the guys that are trained to say you're a little high are all taught to say you're a little high. So they build these models based on, you know, they bring in 100 LSOs and they teach them how to do, you know, they build the data from their speech. And they're remarkably accurate. Like, they get 99.9% accuracy out of their systems, and they truly get 99.9% accuracies with this population. So we said, what would happen if we got people with dysarthria, and we collected data, and we built ASR models based on dysarthria? So similar thing, you know, that there are people that don't necessarily talk in a typical way, but is there enough consistency in their speech to be able to build a model out of that? So we went to collecting data. We collected data at Rancho Los Amigos Medical Center. They helped us a little bit, and at Duke. The goal was to collect these speech samples from individuals with dysarthria secondary to ALS. We chose that population because generally there aren't literacy issues. Our prompts consisted of zip codes, numbers based on zip codes, which were written out. 8 EIGHT, 0 ZERO, so people had to be able to read. And there also was a difference between O and 0, and it matters whether or not you're recording O and 0. So that's why they had to be spelled out. So subjects read 100 zip codes, which were recorded as WAVE files, and we were shooting for 10 sets of data from males and females from each severity group, mild, moderate, severe. Like I said, we recorded them at Duke and Rancho. The data is then verified by us and then sent to NAVAIR to be built into models. We got some equipment for it because I'm an engineer and I like playing with stuff. We got a Shure SM10 headset microphone and a tube amplifier, which was the same equipment that they used down at the Navy for their data collection. And as part of our a research and development agreement, the Navy sent us up a SunSpark station running Unix on which they had this software that they used to collect the data. It was very nice of them, very kind of them, but the system was never where our patients were. So we would go to collect data in, you know, we'd bring it to clinic and there wouldn't be anybody there at clinic. They would show up at our other clinic or in a neurology. So the system was really hard to work with. So we went through a couple generations of development work in porting. We ported the system to a ThinkPad running Linux using the same scripts, and finally to another ThinkPad running XP, where that's until my 10 minutes are up. Okay, so no questions. No questions, yeah. It's good planning on my part. We developed a Java program that would run on a laptop, which would allow us to take it wherever we needed. We also had the ability to, as an idea, that people could download and install and run this and collect their own data. We tested the systems, verified that the quality was good and the consistency of our samples. So we've collected 52 samples to date. We've 30 female and 22 male, and we've got 4 models created. And I just wanted to give a sample of the speech recognition. Those are moderate to severe samples that we're working with, and trying that with a traditional dragon dictator via voice, no chance. So the models that we built were created from 80% of these, 80% of the data, and then the procedure that they use for testing is to reserve 20% and then run it back through the recognizer and see how it does. Our female mild and moderate were 86 and 70%. The male moderate came back at 75% accuracy. The female severe, which the last one was pretty severe, 51% accuracy. There we go. So the discussion. So the word recognition, while it's low, lower than we hoped, it's in line with what we were expecting for the first time through. The recognition rate follows the expected trends in that the more dysarthric somebody is, the lower the recognition is. Proof of concept testing, where we actually then have taken these models and tested it with individuals with dysarthria, different individuals who were not part of the sample, we get similar rates to what we get with the testing. My thing is that the recognition rates that we're getting say this is something that people should be looking into as far as a different way to do speech recognition. What I have found in this process is data collection is really hard to do. You need a lot of data to do it. To collect this digit data, we're collecting thousands of data points. If you wanted to collect a vocabulary of 40 or 60,000 words, you'd need an awful lot of data. The data needs to be very carefully verified as you're collecting it. If you get one O, which was supposed to be a zero, it can really hurt your rates, and that was pretty difficult to do. Switching to other populations, people that have had cognitive impairments, stroke, traumatic brain injury, developmental delay, literacy would become an issue with it. And also, one of the things we've definitely run into is fatigue with some of our more end-stage folks with ALS. So new data collection strategies would be needed, and we've got some ideas about that. I'd be happy to talk about that after. I'd like to acknowledge NIDR, who helped fund the study, our ALS clinic, the CART program at Rancho, NAVAIR Orlando, and the National and Southeast Federal Lab Consortiums. Yes. Yeah. So that's more of a. So the question is, for the iPod here, if you took 80% of Susie's data and built a model, ran 20% of Susie's data through the model, would the recognition rate be higher? That's more of a speaker-dependent system, and I think there's been lots of work that's shown that that's true. If you build a system for one person, the speech recognition rate goes up drastically. So, but what we were really trying to do was build a speaker-independent system so that we could build a system based on that. So I could take it to ALS clinic, and someone who had a moderate, who was female with a moderate dysarthria, could put the headset on, run through the test, and get, 70% recognition accuracy. That's what we were looking at. And our testing like that, although I don't have enough of it to say whether or not it works, shows that it looks like it does. This word recognition is what they call a biased recognition rate. Biased because the 20% is data that's reserved isn't included in the sample. The 20% is from a speaker who's included in the sample. So it's a decent recognition rate, but you would figure that someone who from the outside who wasn't part of the, whose data isn't included, the rate should be a little bit lower. And it's in the right ballpark. How much time do I got? No minutes? One more question? Yeah. Okay, that's a that's an English dysarthria. I didn't quite hear that one. So is it based on an analysis in the time or frequency domain? It's a hidden Markov model. And it's pretty standard. A lot of people are using it. It's an older system, but it's a pretty reliable and robust system. And if anybody knows how to build models, let me know, because I want more models built, and my Navy guys are fighting two wars in the Middle East. So they're a lot harder to get a hold of lately. Okay? Thank you.
All right, we're keeping on time here. Thanks, Kevin. That wasn't exactly 4 minutes, but we'll let it pass. Next, we have Heidi Kester from Kester Performance Research, reliability and validity of Compass software for access assessment. Also, a reminder, especially if you're new to ResNA, you should have received a CD in the mail, and on that CD there should be abstracts or papers that correspond to these papers. So if you want to find out more, get contact information, definitely take a look at that CD. And Kevin says they should also eventually be on the web. I think in the past they put just the abstracts up, and you have to log in to get the full paper.
Oh, right. This isn't my presentation. Okay. As Todd said, my name is Heidi Kester, and I'm going to talk a little bit about our work in the measuring the reliability and validity of some software that we developed for access assessment, which is called Compass. And I've done this work with Rich Simpson and Ed Lopresti, who were with me part of the development team for Compass, and Don Spaeth, who did the data collection for this project. So just as a little background, a few of you may know what Compass is, but I'm guessing not everybody does. So just briefly, it's a software tool. It's a piece of software that's designed for practitioners who perform computer access evaluations, and it helps gather evidence about how well somebody can use their keyboard or keyboard alternative, how well they can enter text, how well they can use a pointing device, navigate through menus, and or use a switch. So it presents a little toolbox of skill tests that you can select from as a practitioner to help you answer questions of, you know, if we move the switch to the left side of the head, are they any quicker or more reliable? Or if we change out the keyboard, does the speed and accuracy change? Or are things changing with time in the way that we would expect? Those kinds of questions it can help you address. And it stores and reports the data that it collects. In addition to developing the system, we did a fair amount of research in looking at usability testing. We wanted it to be very turnkey, you know, load it and run it. It shouldn't be challenging to use. So we were able to verify that. And also it was very important to verify the accuracy of its measurements. So you can easily write a program that tells you something takes 4.8 seconds to do, but let's make sure that that's really true. So we did a lot of video benchmarking, and so we've done a fair amount of that work, but there was still a gap in our research as far as understanding the psychometric properties of these tests. Basically, are they reliable? Can you trust them? You know, from a face validity standpoint, they pretty much make sense, but we wanted to be able to address that in a little more depth. Are they really measuring what we're intending to measure, or what we're telling folks that these are measuring? Okay, so anytime you develop any instrument, whether it's a survey or a measurement tool like Compass, you really want to be able to demonstrate a lot of these properties and measure them. And these are pretty well-established kinds of methods. And we were able to look at four different properties. One, the test-retest reliability. So in other words, if I run you through a compass test right now, and then I have you do the same test 20 minutes from now or tomorrow, how similar are the results for that same person? How much variation is typical? We wanted to look at the intra-test reliability. So if you've used Compass, you know that most of these tests, they present a series of trials that they'll measure from. So there may be targets on the screen, and you may have to do 10 or 12 of these targets, and then it can give you kind of a summary average. So how many of those, can we give people any guidelines into how many trials are typically necessary? We don't want to have too few. You know, you want to have enough information, but you don't want people doing 40 trials when you're getting a bunch of redundant information. We want it to be as efficient as possible. So we wanted to get some information about that. The third property relates to internal consistency, which is basically a term for, you know, this collection of 8 compass tests. Do they kind of hang together and measure kind of an overall computer usage skill kind of construct? And a more specific issue relates to construct validity. Does each compass test measure the particular construct that we say it's measuring? So if we say something is assessing pointing device ability, can we get any data that says, yeah, when you run the AIM test, it really does relate to pointing device ability? Rather than it's our opinion or it seems like it should, we can gather data that can tell us that it does. So we were fortunate enough to partner with the Pittsburgh group that collects data at the PVA wheelchair games every summer. And that formed a pool from which we could recruit people to basically run a bunch of different compass tests for us. And we were able to recruit 15 participants who had physical impairments that affected their ability to use a computer keyboard or mouse. We asked these folks to complete a questionnaire, tell us a little bit about themselves and their computer use. But the main bulk of the protocol was we asked them to do a single run of 3 compass tests, the AIM test, drag test, and switch test. Then we had them repeat those tests, the same exact thing. Then we asked them to do a single run of the text entry test. There are 3 of those, letter, word, and sentence. And then to repeat those. So that gives us our tests and our retests. As I said, they all had physical impairments that affected their ability to use the standard keyboard, but they, all of them could, in fact, use a standard keyboard, whether it was with typing splints or with, you know, knuckle typing, variety of methods. 11 people were typical mouse users, 3 people used a trackball in the experiment, and 1 used a trackpad. Now, in reporting the results, I thought it might make a little more sense if I talk about how we did the analysis and then what the results were for that. For test-retest reliability, there are a variety of ways to do this, but a common way is to calculate a statistic called the intra-class coefficient. So it's basically a special kind of correlation coefficient. You look at the first time we ran the test with all those people and the second time we ran the tests with all those people, and how well do they agree? So not just how well are they correlated, but how well do they actually match up to each other? And what you'd like to see high reliability, and that's generally, the benchmark for that is an ICC above 0.8. We also computed the percent difference between the first test and the second test to give a little more concrete indication of how different they were. So the results, for 9 of the 11 measures that we tested, we got an ICC above 0.8. The other 2 were in the neighborhood of 0.69, you know, medium reliability. So a little bit of an issue there. Both of those were in the letter test, which is a little bit of a funny kind of test. It's not just typing. You just type a single letter. So the first time you see it, you're probably a little slower. The next time you see it, which was the second test, people were generally quite a bit faster, just from familiarity, I think, of the test. When you look at the percent differences, there's a table here. It's a little small. All this stuff is in the full paper in the proceedings. Do I have a pointer? I guess I should have checked that before. But you can see the average for all tests, the absolute difference is about 16% from the first test to the second test. generally the second test is going to be faster. So if you are a clinician and you use Compass, this would suggest to you, let's say I'm looking at trackball A versus a trackpad B. And if I see a difference between those two things, I want to see if the pointing device makes a difference. But just by retesting someone, it's going to make a certain amount of difference. So you really want to be looking at differences above 15% as kind of a meaningful difference. That's why we want to calculate this kind of number, because it does have clinical relevance, and I hope I made that clear. Intratest reliability. This is where we're looking at how many trials are needed. So what we did here, within Compass, you can tell it how many trials you want, but by default, there's a certain number of trials built in. So we divided each test into two halves. For the AIM test, for example, the default was 24 trials. So you look at the first 12 trials and the second 12 trials, and are those two different? So if the second half is different than the first half, it means we're getting new information in the second half. We ought to keep those trials. But if they're not different, then why bother with the second half? It's just redundant information. So we did some statistical analyses on that, and we were able to show, there's a typo on the slide, which I'll get to, but for AIM, DRAG, letter, and word, for four out of the six tests we looked at, they all kind of hang together to look at computing input skills or usage skills. The final property that we measured was construct validity. And again, there's several ways to do this, but the typical way is to do a factor analysis. We did this on the timing data for all the test repetitions that we did. And what you want to see is which outcome measures tend to go together, kind of cluster together in little groups. And what we might expect ahead of time, what we did expect, is that we have tests that relate to text entry. We had those letter, word, and sentence tests. Those things ought to kind of go together. If I'm good at sentence typing, I probably ought to be pretty good at word typing. If those aren't going together, then maybe our test is screwy somehow. Similarly, with pointing devices, our measures from those pointing device tests also ought to cluster together. So we thought we would see two components in factor analysis jargon. We thought we'd see two components with the text entry and pointing device tests in each component. And just to show you here, I'll try